Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now...
Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning. How are you today, Dr. Zan?
I'm excited about science, I'll tell you that.
Always excited
about science. And if you want to get involved with us today, there are a number of ways. The main one which is that you need to give us a call. We just love old-fashioned phone calls.
We call that the POTS or plain old telephone system.
Plain old telephone system. And the way you do that, if you have a science question for Dr. Carl, is 1-300-055-36. Dial that number. If you're having trouble getting through but you do have an answer for us or you've done an experiment or something, you can tweet Dr. Carl at DOCTORKARL, or you can hit us up on the forum, triplej.net.au. There's a dedicated thread. Multicoloured today as well.
Multicoloured.
Thank you
yes.
to my friends on the forum. And 1975 7555 is the text line if you want to post a little answer for us there. You have your hand up, Dr. Carl. What do you have to share with us?
I'm so excited about Jupiter has lost its band.
Really?
Yes.
How did I not see this in the news this week?
What is wrong with the news that we don't see this sort of stuff? Because what happened was that Jupiter has on its surface, Jupiter, the giant planet, 10 times bigger in diameter than the Earth.
Mm.
Huge, biggest planet in the solar system. Accounts for something like 90%+ of the weight of all of the stuff in the solar system that is not a planet. It has had on it the Great Red Spot that has been basically a cyclone running for 400 years, four centuries, three times bigger than the Earth. And running around Jupiter, surrounding Jupiter at the level of the Great Red Spot is a band, a dark-coloured band. And a little while ago, Jupiter went behind the sun. And when it popped out on the 23rd of May, the band was gone.
How long has it been there? As long as we've known?
It comes and it goes with time.
Okay.
But it was not anywhere in the newspapers, nor was it in any of the 4,000 junk emails offering Viagra, my new best friend in Nigeria, cheap and thin copper foil from, where is it now, China at the moment, and also free videos.
So what does it mean that this ring is gone?
Well,
what does it
know.
Mean for science?
It's not a ring. There are rings of Saturn, and there are mini, mini micro rings of Jupiter. This is a band on the surface of the planet, and it's gone. Why wasn't it in the newspapers, I ask you? Okay, to the audience.
All right, let's get into some talkback. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call, and Gav in Brisbane has done that. Hi, Gav. Whoa.
Hey,
Gav.
Hello.
Oh.
Hi, Gav.
Hello. Gav, can you take us off for your hands-free?
I can do that.
That would be great.
Much better quality.
What's your question, Gav?
Hello, you there?
Yeah.
G'day, Jessica. How are you going?
Good. Now, can you just back off from the microphone a bit? You're shouting a bit and overloading the microphone, so just back off a little bit and then talk normally.
How are you going? Is that better?
Oh, we love you, Dr. Gav.
I just had a question. I've been having some strange dreams recently, and I actually sort of put it on Facebook to a few friends, and they said possibly if you have cheese before you go to bed, it may alter your dreams and affect your dreams. Is that true? Have you heard anything about that before?
We've heard this a few times before, haven't we?
A few times. This is possibly an example of the Dunning-Kruger effect, where the supremely confident are also the invincibly ignorant. The less you know, the more confident you are. What I can tell you about dreams is this. Number one, they're not all that weird. They're just ordinary things stuck together. So you ordinarily will go to the beach, and ordinarily you'll go into a shop. But if you go into a shop and then you go into the change room and you walk into the beach, then you put two ordinary things together and it looks weird. That's the first thing about strange dreams. The second thing is that you're more likely to remember your dreams if you wake up shortly after you have the dream. If you wake up 5 minutes after it, you've got a chance of remembering it. 20 minutes later, forget it. 1 minute later, you'll definitely remember it. Number three, is there something about cheese that makes you wake up after you've had a dream, or it just makes you wake up a lot and the dream is enough to bring you into reality? Don't know the answer to that one, Dr. Gav. I'm giving you a definite don't know.
Okay, well, that's good. Yeah, I just wondered because, like I said, I had a few friends that say, you know, cheese before bed to some stranger.
Yeah, it's one we've heard before, but we haven't got any conclusive evidence, so yeah.
Peer-reviewed paper, come on out with it, audience.
Thanks for the call, Gav.
Right,
thank you.
Thanks,
see you later. Jeremy's calling in from Taree. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, doctors.
What's
Hi.
Your question for Dr. Carl?
I have a question about throat lozenges you have when you have a sore throat. Whenever I have, say I have a scale of 1 to 10 of a sore throat, if I have, on a scale 1 and have throat lozenges, my throat will get sore, worse to a point, and then get better. But say it's like a 5 on the scale, it'll just get better.
And 5 is really sore, really tender?
Yeah, really sore and really tender. And then, yeah, actually, if it's just a little bit, it'll get worse to like that point and then get better.
What do you mean worse?
Like it'll get sore and more tender.
Okay. I have an answer, which is completely wrong, but I'll give it and then I'll follow up by an I don't know.
Wonderful.
First part, if I was thinking you had a very inflamed throat, then virtually any floating chemicals would make it feel worse.
Yeah.
However, in your case, you're saying that when it's only very mildly inflamed, does it then hurt? And if it's heavily inflamed, then it doesn't hurt. Number two, I don't know.
Okay.
So that's the second in a row where I don't know, and I am ignorant and proud of it.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy.
No worries. Thank you, Doctor.
All right, let's see if we can hit this one, Dr. Carl. Joanne's calling in from Stotts Creek. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Joanne.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question with regards to lightning. We have a pressure-sensitive doormat out the front, which makes the doorbell ring inside when somebody steps on the mat.
A doormat?
I've never heard of this. At the front door.
Have you ever heard of a pressure-sensitive doormat? Normally, the doorbell rings when a person puts their finger on the button. But here, all I have to do is just put their... I've never heard of it. How long has this strange technology been around?
It's the future.
It's the future. This is some crazy 21st century stuff.
No, it's great because you know when the cat's sitting at the front door waiting to come in then.
So what's the deal with the doormat, Joanne?
Yeah, well, the funny thing with the doormat is when we're having an electrical storm going overhead, a split second before the actual lightning goes, we hear the doorbell go off and then we see a big flash of lightning and it only happens when it's right overhead.
And it's definitely not the cat.
Definitely not the
catch. Hang on. Let me just get the timing. You're saying that a split second before, before the flash, which travels at the speed of light, a split second before the flash, the doormat goes off. Can I ask you, is the doormat getting its power from internal batteries? Or we couldn't have had this conversation 10 years ago. is your doormat a powered doormat? Does it get its power from 240 volt off the grid or does it get off batteries?
The bell is plugged into the power point.
But what about the doormat itself? Does the doormat talk to the...
No.
So the doormat has batteries and it's got some sort of radio... Firstly, it's got a pressure sensor and then it's got a radio transmitter that sends a signal at some frequency, don't know what it is, to the doorbell.
That's right. The doorbell is actually plugged into the PowerPoint.
Well, I'm reckoning that what you're getting is a sudden jump in voltage. And I would have thought, you see, what happens is that in electric, for lightning to happen, and there's about 12 different forms of lightning, I'm sorry to say, not just the regular from the cloud to the ground as it appears, but there's 12 different types. It's got more, we know much more about it. There are sort of things called, red sprites and blue jets. And the red sprites can fill a volume of 10,000 cubic kilometres of lightning.
Wow.
They're just huge. Lightning is big. Okay. And I would have thought that the way it happens is that you've got a wind and then you get separation of charge. So the ground is one charge, the cloud is the other charge. The electrical tension builds up and like electrical tension, like sexual tension, it has to be relieved. And then suddenly there's this jump. And I would have thought that at the moment that the lightning flash happens and then travels to your eyes at the speed of light, at that moment, as the big change happens, as the electrical charge gets released, then a big electrical spike comes out and triggers your electric doormat. But you're saying it happens a fraction of a second, and going by how slow we humans are, I'd say that'd be at least a third of a second. For my third case, I'm saying I don't know. I reckon it's some sort of spike, but why it's happening before, I don't know. I would have thought it would have happened at the same time, but not before the lightning flash.
Do you reckon that someone who specialises in electric-sensored doormats would be listening?
It's a fairly specialised job, but could you please come out of the woodwork, sir or madam?
If you are, please give us a call on 1300 055 36 or text us 1975 7555. We'll see if we can get to the bottom of it for you, Joanne. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
See you later.
Thank you, Dr. Joanne.
Electric doormats.
Who would have heard of such a thing?
It's like 3D TVs. Madness.
That's craziness.
Madness. We've got a caller from China, Dr. Carl. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello there.
Whereabouts in China are you calling from?
From a city called Ningbo.
Ningbo. Have you been there, Dr. Carl?
No, and I'll use my only bit of Chinese. Ni hao.
Ni hao, Dr. Carl.
What's your question for Carl today, Jennifer?
Wellington, a fairly small city in comparison with the rest of China. When I go out, I can be the only Westerner that I see in this city for quite a few days, and I'm the only one that I notice that wears sunglasses. And my husband and I were discussing whether, through evolution, whether the shape of the retina in European people are different to the shape of the retina in Asian people, and whether you think eventually it will change.
Ah.
So that, like, do Asian people not wear sunglasses because they don't need to? Or, like, I couldn't possibly not go out and wear sunglasses. It's very glary, but the Asian people don't seem to wear them.
Ah. Okay, you've got two ways of reducing the amount of light landing on the inside of your eyeball. The first one is to have the iris, the coloured bit at the front, closed down. And if it's light in colour, that's different from being dark in colour. The Chinese tend to have very dark coloured irises, so this pseudoscience called iridology does not work on Chinese because you simply cannot see the iris. Then the light comes through the little hole and lands on the rods and cones in the retina. Think of them as little corn stalks, like a plant sticking up, like a stick sticking up. And what happens is that when it is very bright, a layer called the pigment epithelium advances forward from ground level and rises up through the corn to almost cover all of the corn. And maybe they've got a more efficient system so that it dims down the light.
So because we've got blue eyes, we notice the glare more.
Yes.
Like, because we've got light-coloured eyes.
That's right. You notice the glare more. So,
yes.
But why none of them at all have sunglasses, I don't know how much of a social effect is involved.
Yeah, I was wondering that too. Is it just a cultural thing?
Might be as well. Have you tried asking them?
It's getting more popular for a fashion effect, but
yes.
Definitely not for, like, we wear it for a protection sort of thing. But, you know, so for a fashion thing, you know, there's a few more people wearing them, the younger ones wear them, but definitely not for, you know, for sun protection or anything like that.
Oh.
And I can definitely be the only one out and get looked at, like, you know, why are you wearing them?
In my case, I had herpes of the eyeball when I was 16 years old and almost went blind, and ever since then I've been very sensitive to sunlight and squint like crazy,
yeah,
unless I'm wearing full wraparound Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator sunglasses.
Like, on really, really glary days, I think, how can you not have them on, you know?
Yeah.
So, but it might be natural protection.
Well, just ask them, are they not wearing them because they don't need to, or because sunglasses are too expensive, or because they look different from all of their friends who don't wear sunglasses?
Yeah, that might be what it is.
So can you VoIP us next week and tell us, Dr. Jenny?
Okay, I'll try.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer.
Thank you.
See you later. Renee's calling in from Townsville, a little bit closer to home. Hi, Renee.
Hi,
what's your question?
Okay, it isn't really sciencey, but whatever. I heard that before the 1980s, homosexuality was considered a disease, and I want to know, is there any scientific evidence or reasoning behind that, or is it more people's beliefs that drove that diagnosis?
Ah, well, it's the Dunning-Kruger effect again, where people who are ignorant are supremely confident. There used to be a disease called drapetomania. D-R-A-P-E-T-O, mania. And what it was a disease of the brain, a mental disease that caused black or Negro slaves in America in 1851 to want to flee captivity. He thought, he being the American physician Samuel A. Cartwright, that black people really liked being in captivity. And if they wanted to escape from it, stop being slaves, well, they suffered from this disease called drapetomania. And the treatment of it was, you know, a severe beating and a flogging. Well, that's just crazy. And to call homosexuality a disease falls into the same category.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right, thanks for the call, Renee.
Bye.
Michael's calling in from Canberra. Hi, Michael.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I just wanted to know, what causes, like, muscle cramps in your body and that? Because my dog keeps having these muscle cramps, and not sure if there's something that I can put in the diet to stop that from happening.
I've got to give you a straight don't know on that, and if somebody could give us an answer on that, that's wonderful, because I've heard so many things that contradict each other. I've heard too much salt, too little salt and lactic acid, too much exercise,
yeah,
and too little exercise. Mate, what's the answer? Give us an answer.
Do we need a sports scientist to help us out?
Yes, but then what about the cramps that you get when you're just lying in bed and suddenly for no reason, bow, you got your leg curled up under your buttocks because it's cramping? What's that all about?
Yeah, it's true. All right, we'll see if we can get an answer for you before the morning's out. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
See you later. Tiffany's calling in from Byron Bay. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, Dr. Carl and Dr. Dan.
Good morning. What's your question?
My question is, we're actually driving on our way to Melbourne at the moment, and we noticed around Goulburn there were some large rocks, like really large rocks around the landscape, and some of these were even piled on top of each other, but they didn't seem to fit in the landscape, so we were wondering what they were made from or where they came from.
Well, firstly, they're not meteors. Even though I was in Alice Springs last week and Henbury meteor craters and Box Hole meteor crater and Goss's Bluff, lots of meteor craters. They're not meteors. They're almost certainly some sort of geological activity. I know that's a really dumb thing to say. And geology is probably one of the fields about which I know very little. And I'm almost thinking that if you're in high altitudes, rocks that look out of place could be related to glacial activity. Now, here's something weird. Mm. During the last 3 million years, during which time the human brain has virtually doubled in size from, say, 600 to 1,200 cc's. During that last 3 million years, the normal state of affairs on our planet is an ice age. That's normal. It is normal that for 100,000 years there's an ice age, that there are glaciers on the Great Dividing Range in Australia, that the ice is 1 kilometre thick over New York and Germany, and that the water to make this ice has come out of the oceans, which has dropped down by about 100, 120 metres. And then we're in an abnormal stage at the moment called between the glaciers or between the glacials or interglacial, and that lasts about 10 to 20,000 years. So what I think you're seeing, if you're seeing rocks that look out of place,
yep,
are rocks that were put there by glacial activity.
Oh, okay. Because we've seen them also in Victoria and in New Zealand and also up in the moors in England.
Ah. So, if we could have a geologist ring in. And what particular area are you talking about, Dr. Tiffany, so we can give a name of the area you've seen them in Victoria to the geologist?
We're actually still in New South Wales in Goulburn, around Goulburn area.
Okay. Goulburn. Thank
we'll
you
see
very
if we
much.
Can find out for you. Thanks for the call, Tiffany.
Thanks very much.
And good luck with
bye
the
bye.
Drive as well.
Thank you.
Ed's calling in from Hobart today. Good morning, Ed.
Hi, Dr. Ed.
Ed, are you there?
Hi, Dr. Ed. Mr. Ed?
I can hear him in the distance.
Ed, come through. Actually, I had a fellow physics person in the School of Physics who said that his whole reason in life to get a PhD was that they wouldn't call him Mr. Ed like the horse, but Dr. Ed. Hi, Ed Gerstner. How are you going?
All right, let's see if Maggie is around.
Come on,
calling in from Hay. Hi, Maggie, are you there?
Hey, I am. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question about lithium. Mm-hmm. Now, I take lithium as a tablet form, and it's also in batteries, and I was wondering where it comes from and how it can be in both things.
There are about 92 or so natural elements, and lithium is one of the lightest elements. It's the third element. You've got hydrogen, which is the lightest of all, then helium, then lithium. And it gets manufactured inside stars as they burn and give us energy. Now, lithium is used in batteries, and I'm not sure exactly what it is about its electrical properties that makes it so wonderful. Maybe it's its low density, but certainly lithium batteries have a lot of energy density, lots and lots of recharge cycles, and a very small memory effect. Nickel cadmium.
So where does it come from, though? Like, is it from the ground? Do they get it out of the air?
Oh, no. Firstly, it's in stars, and the stars generate their heat by turning hydrogen into helium and lithium. Then the star explodes. The lithium, along with the hydrogen and the helium, gets thrown out into space and ends up in giant clouds with other things. Eventually, you get some sort of gravitational collapse, and then planets form. The planets start off molten hot, and then the lithium, because it's so low in density, tends to rise towards the surface. So it's mined in the ground, but I don't know exactly what the sort of mining is. Why it works in humans, medically, to treat depression, it was discovered in 1946, I think, by a guy in Melbourne called, I think it was Cade.
Yeah, an Australian.
Yeah, C-A-D-E.
Oh, wow.
And then it was poorly understood. And then just last week I read in Nature magazine they're working out the mechanism by which it happens. And it's really complicated and involves all sorts of receptors that I've forgotten the name of. But adenosine might be in there somewhere.
There was a great documentary actually in the film festivals running around a couple of years ago about the discovery of lithium by Cade.
Yeah,
which I'd sort of, I'd never known that an Australian had discovered it as well. So obviously, you know, a big help to a lot of people around the world. But it comes from exploding stars, Dr. Carl.
Exploding stars, as do most of the elements in your body.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Maggie.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
See you later. And we've had a few things, a few answers coming through on the text line about why people cramp. Someone texted in and said, I researched muscle cramps when I was pregnant and found that the most plausible explanation was magnesium deficiency. I took magnesium and they went away. Someone else says, try magnesium and calcium or shark's cartilage. And apparently Lauren in Brizzy's personal trainer says magnesium helps cramps and I found it works. So magnesium, the overriding answer coming through on the text line. Does that make sense to you?
Why would you be low in magnesium? Where do you get magnesium from in your diet?
Stars.
Stars. Very well done. And we have some more answers off our wonderful friend, the interweb. And with regard to lithium, according to Sketchy Fletchy, lithium has very high electronegativity. In other words, it can inherently generate lots of volts and is very low in density, so that's good for batteries. And people talking about the doorbell are talking about the perhaps surge of ground current associated with the leader formation before the strike actually happens. So this, you're getting a rapid build-up in electrical tension. That would be enough to trigger it off. Thank you, Mr. VK2Z or ZAY.
Thanks to everyone who's giving their answers. You can tweet Dr. Carl at DOCTORKARL or text in any answers, 1975-7555. Call us, though, if you've got a question, like Phil in Brisbane does. Hi, Phil.
G'day, how you going?
Good, you've got a great question. What is it?
Dr. Carl.
Dr. Phil.
This has worried me for some years. If you could make a box or a sphere, the inside of which is lined with perfect mirrors, and you opened it up to the light and then quickly shut the lid, would there be light bouncing around inside that box or would it be dark?
I have trouble from a physics point of view, bearing in mind that I am not a real physicist, with the concept of a perfect mirror. You have, now I'm going to tell you something very important. You ready for this one? Because I got this from a clever person.
Yep.
Light travels as a wave, comma, but it's a photon when it is born or dies. So you've got the beam of light traveling as a wave through the vacuum inside your little mirrored box. It hits the mirror. It then turns into a photon.
Right.
Then it is absorbed and then re-emitted back. There has to be some loss of energy. You can't have a perfect mirror.
Okay.
But let's just suppose theoretically you could have a perfect mirror. Well, then whatever brightness was in there at the moment that you very quickly closed the box, it would just stay that brightness indefinitely.
So the reason that it would be dark is that there'd be just a subsequent loss of energy until finally there was none left.
Because the light would be getting absorbed at the mirror surface and getting turned into a low-grade form of energy, which we call heat.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Thanks for the call, Phil.
Thank you, Dr. Good Phil.
See you later.
Thank you.
Kate's calling in from Mornington. Hi, Kate.
Hello. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning,
Dr. Kate.
Hello. I've just got a question about stars.
Yeah.
Another stars question. Last night we were having a very clear night down in the peninsula and we noticed a star that was quite low to the horizon, and we all saw that it was flashing orange and red and greens and blues to our eye. We saw those colours. And at first I said, oh, look, there's a helicopter, it must be hovering, but it actually didn't move for about 5-10 minutes. We stood there watching it. So we're wondering, we assume it's a star, but could it be a satellite? I just said last night, I'm calling Dr. Carl tomorrow to ask him what was that.
Satellites are very common, and even in most cities around Australia, if you get 2 or 3 kilometres out of the business district, if you can see stars, you can see satellites. The best time to see them is in the hour and a half immediately after sundown. They have the characteristic that they move, and mostly they have the characteristic that they are a steady light. Some of the satellites, such as the Iridium satellites that work, the Iridium phones that work best near the North and South Poles and worst near the equator because they're further apart, they all cross over the poles. The Iridium satellites have got big slab sides. they rotate slowly, and you'll see this thing going across, and suddenly it'll flash at you as it gets a perfect angle of reflection from the sun. Yes. Something that stayed in one place and had many different coloured flashing lights, I would tend to think of as a helicopter hovering over something.
I immediately thought that must be a helicopter, but it just wasn't actually moving.
Well, helicopters can do that hover thing.
5 to 10 minutes?
Oh, until they run out of fuel.
Yeah. It seemed the size of a star, but it seemed closer and lower to the horizon.
Yeah, very so possible to see satellites from Earth, isn't it, Dr.
Yeah, it is. And what do you need? I think with our good friend the interweb, you might be able to contact some. Is there a way that you can find odd things in the heavens? Like one day we were at the School of Physics and there was this big smell of smoke in the air and people were complaining, hey, I can't find out by the internet where all this smoke is coming from. And finally somebody managed to get into the fire brigade and find that they were doing some controlled burning in the Blue Mountains some 100 yeah. kilometres away.
How does that relate to satellites?
Well, maybe with so much awareness of the world around us, you'll be able to say, I'm here at such and such a geographical location and I'm looking to the east and what I can see is this. Anybody over there to the east of me can see this. Please help.
You're starting well and you're asking the questions. Thanks for the call,
yes.
Kate.
Thank you, Dr. Kate.
See you later. Ben's calling in from Newcastle. Good morning, Ben.
Hi, Dr. Ben. Welcome to the show.
Ben.
And just filling in while Ben
good to,
is
good to hear, Ben,
there.
The freeway that Ben's on.
But a real estate agent shoved a little brochure, a flyer in my letterbox trying to sell a house nearby. And he said, this fine house has, and I quote, a side northerly aspect. Isn't side northerly meaning east or west and not as attractive as north?
Let's see if Ed in Hobart's on the line. Hi,
Come on,
Ed.
Hi, Dr.
Hey,
or Mr.
Guys,
Ed.
How you going?
Good, thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks for staying on the line. What's your question?
No worries. I was wondering if you guys could settle a debate that's been raging between me and a mate of mine for a little while. I'm a surfer and he's a swimmer, and we were debating what generates more power in a swimmer's body, the arms or the legs, because I find when I swim I don't kick much.
Okay. I'm not a sports physiologist, but here's my answer from what little I know. Number one, I'm reckoning that the arms generate most of the forward thrust. And the muscles that are involved are the same muscles that are involved in you as a surfer paddling out to the waves or paddling across. The latissimus dorsi, which is Latin for the widest muscles of the back. Lat means wide, latissimus means widest, dorsi of the back. Same muscles right. are involved in pulling your arm down for swimming or for rowing. However, you need some leg action to keep your legs up. So you are parallel to the surface of the water because that then reduces the drag. So the kicking action does two things. It keeps your legs up, which reduces the drag, and it provides, I think, I'm guessing on this, a smaller amount of forward propulsion. So if you could, so I think that's it. And if a sports physiologist could Twitter or ring in, I'd be very happy.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Ed. Right now we've got time for a few more questions with Dr. Carl and maybe even some answers from Dan, the webcam man. Dan, talk to us. What are you giving us an answer for?
Well, earlier there was a question about satellites and being able to see satellites from Earth.
Mm.
Now, a certain very popular smartphone brand that has applications which people call about apps.
Yeah. The app store. Yes, I think we know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I thought so. There's a bunch of applications for that which will let you track satellites, including the Iridium ones that Dr. Carl was speaking about and the International Space Station, and tell you when they're going to be passing by overhead near you, and if it's nighttime and if there aren't clouds, then you can see them streak by.
Awesome. So if you're a satellite nerd, there are apps to help you.
There's an app for that.
Track is an app for everything. All right, thanks, Dan. Let's go back into some talkback. 1-300-055-336 if you've got a question for us. Charles in Brisbane, you've got an interesting one for us.
Hey, I was reading the Darwin Awards, and one of them was a guy drunk himself to death by pouring alcohol into his bum.
Mm.
And I wanted to know if that could actually happen, and if so, why?
Ah, yes. Your gut runs from your lips down to your bum. And it's about 10 metres long, so it goes through your mouth, your esophagus, your stomach, small intestine, large intestine, rectum, anus, and so forth. Along the way, it can absorb stuff, and in all the way along in your gut, the blood, which is picking up chemicals of the food that you're eating, goes firstly to the liver, and then is slowly released as required into the general bloodstream. If you did not do that, if you had a meal and you ate fats, proteins and carbohydrates and they went straight from your gut into your bloodstream, you would die. You would have swelling of the brain or shrinkage of the brain, depending on what you were eating. So it goes to the liver first. The only part where it does not go to the liver is at each end, under the tongue and in the bum. So you might know some people who have got a little bit of heart pain and they get a nitroglycerine tablet, which opens up the blood vessels. This was discovered by accident when the people working in the nitroglycerine factory would have headaches. Why were they having headaches? Because the blood vessels in their brain were opening up. Mm. You know, it was just getting into their system. So if the people with pain, you can see them walking up a hill and they're getting a little bit of chest pain, they stop. They do not swallow the nitroglycerine tablet because if they do, it'll get detoxified by their liver. They put it under their tongue and it goes directly into their bloodstream. And at the other end, in the last few centimetres of the bummel area, that's a new word I just made up.
Bummel.
Bummel, B-U-M-M-A-L, anal area, it goes directly into the bloodstream. And so if you are a parent of a newborn child, you will buy your 44-gallon drum of some sort of Panadol and a few Panadol suppositories.
Yeah.
So when the little kitty is vomiting and threatening to dehydrate, you can bring and having a fever, you can bring the fever down by squirting it up their bum, the little suppository. You just put it in the last few centimetres of their bum and it gets absorbed. And when I was at the kids' hospital, it was there that they brought in the treatment of squirting Valium up in the bum because you got a little kid who's having a fit. Right, it's hard enough to find a blood vessel in a two-day-old baby. Forget, you know, you've really got to know what you're doing, and I certainly didn't. And some people came up with the idea that you just get a syringe, you know, a little bottle of Valium and crack it open, put it into a syringe, but no needle, just a plastic end, and then just squirt up the baby's bum and pull the buttocks together and hold it there, and they absorb enough through the back end of the bum. So with regard to absorbing alcohol, you can absorb, and apparently enough alcohol to kill yourself. Do not do this experiment at home, folks.
That's why it's in the Darwin Awards book.
Yes.
All right, thanks for the call, Charles.
Yes, Dr. Charles. Thank you, Dr. Charles. I didn't sorry.
You're appreciative. Christy from Invalides on the line. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Dr. Christy.
Hi,
welcome.
Hello.
Thank you. Okay, so about 6 months ago, I was bitten by a redback spider, and I actually found it in my bra, of all places. So I was actually quite sick and I needed 2 vials of the anti-venom. And I guess my question today, doctors, is if I was in the unlikely case bitten again by a spider, by a redback, would my body build up a bit of a resistance to the poison or would I be more susceptible?
Ah, did they give you the anti-venom?
Yes, they did. 2 vials of it, actually, because it's a slow emanating process. So after about 9 hours, the symptoms really kicked in and it goes through the lymph nodes as opposed to the bloodstream. So it was a very slow process and by that time it had kind of kicked in through the body and so I needed a bit of a double dose.
Ah, and normally I think it's of the order of $5,000 an ampule, which you have to pay if you are in America or you have a pet. But because we have a fine medical system and you pay taxes over your whole life, then you get it back on occasions like this.
Yeah.
There are two possibilities. Okay, then the poisons, and there are a whole bunch of them. There are neurotoxins and there are poisons to split cell membranes apart and split tissue planes apart. So there's all sorts of nasty poisons in there. Does your body make antibodies to them to fight them off? Probably. Does it make them quickly enough? No. So what you are getting is a collection of these antibodies, and just to have a mental image, an antibody looks like the letter Y. Mm. The open jaws of the letter Y grab the poison chemical, and the tail lights up and it says to a macrophage, which is a cell in your body, come and eat me, destroy me. Mm. And so it's a flag. Now, you can have two different pathways happening here. One, and this happens in some beekeepers, they get stung so often that their immune system kicks in and they make these antibodies and they're virtually immune to bee stings. And you have the opposite happening, that they make antibodies and the antibodies, besides fighting the bad guys, also fight themselves.
Mm.
And so they can get killed by it. And with regard to this antibody thing, the typical case that you find, and I'm just thinking about this because I've just come back from Alice Springs, where it happens in Aboriginal kids in Australia much more than white kids, is they get an infection, I think it's by a beta hemolytic strep type 17B or something. They get a sore throat, and the sore throat goes away. They make antibodies to it, and by a terrible coincidence, the antibodies knock off their joints, so they get an arthritis, and knock off the mitral valve in their heart. So that's rheumatic heart fever. And if it happens to one white kid, everybody jumps up and down and says, "How did this happen? Why didn't the doctor give him antibiotics?" If it happens to another black kid, they say, "Oh yeah, you're number 234 we found this year."
So if Christy was bitten again, would she have
luck of the draw?
Luck of the draw.
It could go that she's well on the way to getting immunity. And I'm really sorry that I got you in the bra.
Yeah, I really hope that never happens again. That is scary.
I know. Or it could go the other way. It just depends on what sort of antibodies and what sort of receptors are standing on your joints and on your mitral valve in your heart.
No, thanks for the call, Christy.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I think we've got time for one more quick one. Sita is calling in from Doon Doon. Hi, Sita.
Hi, Sita. Welcome to the show.
What's your question?
Well, when I was 10 years old, I had the chicken pox. And not long after it disappeared, or pretty much as it was disappearing, I woke up with half of my face paralysed. And so I went to the doctor, and the doctor told me that it was Bell's palsy. Now, all these years I had acupuncture treatment to get rid of the paralysation, but I'm left with a lazy eye. But my question is, how did the chickenpox connect with the paralysation?
In your case, the paralysis happened because of an inflammation of the seventh cranial nerve, known as the facial nerve, almost certainly at a place where it comes out through a very narrow hole in your skull. And it swelled, and the swelling caused it to get paralyzed, and sometimes it get better, and sometimes it doesn't. It can cause a lip drop, it can cause an eye drop, depending on what it is. We do not really know the cause, and we do not really know the specific pathway by which an infection with chickenpox, which is caused by the virus VZV, or VZV for an American listeners, or varicella zoster virus, we do not know the specific pathway by which it causes the inflammation. We know there's inflammation. We do not know exactly how.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Sita.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks to everyone who called today. Don't forget, if you came in halfway, you can download the whole podcast, Sans Music, at triplej.net.au. We're going to have it up for you shortly after midday today. Dr. Carr, we'll see you back here next Thursday.
Peachy keen.